Hey there, and you're very welcome to Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a marketplace connecting sophisticated investors with relevant private market opportunities and sponsors of the Irish Rugby Sevens teams. This podcast explores the intersection of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and what are the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. We're delighted to welcome our guest for this episode, Ronan O'Gara, the head coach of La Rochelle. Ronan, you're very welcome. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Connor. It's great to be on.
Maybe to kick things off, tell us a little bit about the current role with La Rochelle.
Essentially, I'm the head coach or manager, as they call it in France, which would be more along, I suppose, the soccer version of an Alex Ferguson or, Kevin Keegan with Newcastle. Essentially, you're the boss for the rugby. You have a president in the French system who is obviously very powerful and respected. Then there's a kind of CEO who runs the club. And with that, you kind of have a director sportif or sporting director and assistant coaches, medical team, strength and conditioning team, and obviously a big playing group. So, yeah, it sounds complicated, but we try and keep it simple. We're in the business of rugby. We're in the business of enjoyment of, if it's a job, it's not what it's meant to be. We're kind of in a very privileged position where we get to do what we love and make a good living from it.
And maybe from the perspective of coaching, I mean, was it always something you thought you'd end up doing when you were playing, or you weren't thinking beyond playing, or what was the journey?
There's a few stages to that, and it's very good as a coach, I think, now to understand those probably stages in a player's head. I think the ultimate competitors, they're very short-term focused and they live in the now. But then towards the latter stages of your career, I think, probably 2 years out from the finishing line as a player, I knew I wanted to coach, or maybe not coach, but I knew I wanted to be involved in a team because I could see how it could, or I could bring value potentially to a group. So I think, for 10 years, 11 years, 12 years, 13 years, you're just chasing that next victory. And then I was lucky in my position to probably be the number one for a very long period of time. Then a competitor comes along and you kind of think, well, I'll get his measure. And then your competitor overtakes you and you play the role of a sub, which is very, very interesting and important as well. And then you kind of slip away to seeing the guys who have never had the opportunity to be a starter or a replacement over a long period of time. And the numbers 30 to 45 are essentially so crucial to your environment and will determine whether you are successful or not, Connor, in the long and short term, because these guys have emotions. Some of these guys have family. Some of these guys have really strong values and they need to feel appreciated. And I found as probably as a player watching other players, they didn't feel that love from coaches and they were lost to the group and it was a big negative. So I'd be very conscious of the role they play within the group. The solution isn't easy because, all players aren't the same. You've got better players and you need your better players to perform, but you also need your squad players to have a huge role in the team.
No, absolutely. I was going to ask you a question about the transition and, was it difficult to transition from a high-performing athlete to a coach? But it sounds like there was a number of transitions on the journey there based on what you described through those various phases. Is that fair to say?
It is, I suppose for the listener, I think the end is brutal. I don't think there's anything comparable in business or in anything else. The end of a rugby player, soccer, sportsman, woman's journey, it's using the words beyond humiliating is probably accurate, because you lose, I suppose, everything that you stood for overnight with it for 15 years. You lose it overnight, especially I think people will say, he was lucky he tasted the highs, he played in Croke Park in front of 80,000 people all around the world. But the more you taste that, the more you want it and the more it becomes an empty and the more you can't have it, So you're going from, especially from personally speaking, you are the kicker. So you're playing an individual sport within a team sport where at the end of it, you craved the opportunity to kick a winning penalty or drop goal in front of 80,000 people. And then that's gone. But then also your teammates are gone. So I think that's probably changed a lot in the last 24 months. I think people have got better with appreciating the importance of mental health and sportswomen and sports people. But from my own point of view, it was, you know, I think the reality is I removed myself from my environment, which was Cork, Munster, to, I suppose, be able to cope with the afterlife, because it was just probably too difficult for me mentally to live with how will Munster get on at the weekend, because it's not your team and the show goes on and you've had your time and you have to appreciate it, but it's someone else's time now, but you still want to do it.
No, exactly. And I, you know, you hear about the group and being part of the group and, you know, going from a WhatsApp group and messaging between the players to not being there anymore kind of thing, as you say, is overnight, right? So it's you don't have much time to think about it.
If it's a very good group, and I think my generation of being a Munster team and Ireland team were very, very, very good groups. You know, it wasn't, for example, a group thrown together. It was a group built on an awful lot of, I suppose, good values. And to this day, we remain very good friends, which signifies a lot. So I think that's very important to stay too. It's not just, you know, nowadays there are WhatsApp groups for everything. You have a WhatsApp group for, what I mean? A dinner on Saturday the 13th of May or whatever, you know. But when it's your rugby team and you care deeply about them, that's a big empty in your life.
No, for sure. And how would you, if you think about it now, I mean, your experiences as a player, how do you compare them to the highs now as a coach? I mean, it's a different type of a high, I guess, but it's still a competitive buzz.
Yeah, it's very different, I would think. And I think that's probably important to stress too. Yes, they're in the similar sports, but the careers are completely different. A rugby player to a rugby coach is, it's like, I suppose the job or the characteristics or requirements are very, very different. You know, I think what is blatantly obvious more as you go along, more experience as a coach, the global vision is very, very important. Yet I think success comes with the detail. While as a player, it's all about how does change affect me or how do I get the best out of myself? And you got to invest in yourself because essentially, by strengthening yourself as a player, you're going to make the group better. But the coach has to be able to look at what's best for the team and be able to make an unpopular decision if he feels it's the right decision to make the group stronger, be it short-term or long-term. And it's a very, I would say, lonely, isolated spot at time because, you know, you got to make brave decisions at times that, and essentially you'll be judged on that. But what isn't tolerated, I suppose, from my point of view, was yes man. You know, if you're a yes man, you're not going to make it, you know.
And if you think about, I mean, as a player, you would have had senior and leadership roles as well. And did they contribute to the style of coaching that you have, or is it very different?
No, it would definitely. It would definitely, I think, subconsciously be always kind of inside you, I suppose, with your planning, with your perception of how you feel the game should be played, where you feel you can get an advantage. And that's the fascinating thing about rugby. It's played by all shapes and different sizes. And that's why I think you need a really good team around you, even if I am the boss or the leader, because you mean the mentality of a front row forward to a second row forward, I cannot grasp that because I'm a number 10 and there's no point in thinking you can, because we don't think at all similarly. You know, to give an example, in the current game, you know what you mean, a Tadhg Furlong is very, very different thinking to a Hugo Keenan. But that doesn't mean either of them is right or wrong. It's just how they see the game, because there are so many things in rugby that you need to be good at that require, I suppose, different skill sets to a game of soccer, which essentially is a lot about, I suppose, control and manipulating your opposition. But I think that's the fascinating area of rugby, that you try and keep it simple, yet it's quite a complex subject. But to be successful, it's, for me, one of the big things was it's doing the simple things well over and over again at high intensity, at high tempo.
Maybe to talk a little bit about learnings from different units that you've worked with. How do you bring those learnings from one to another? Or is there a particular approach or a mindset that you take into to a given week or a unit or a squad? Or how do you think about those kind of things?
That's interesting, actually, because your question has triggered, I suppose, something that I would base my performance week on. It's kind of a triangle where you have skill set, structure and mindset. So how does that look like from a player's point of view or from a coach's point of view? So the head coach is responsible for the mindset. If there's an issue with attitude or lack of attitude, that's a big failing on my behalf. If you can look at a game and see my team suffering from a lack of want, a lack of attitude, that's how I would judge myself on, and that would be a big issue if that was to surface in a game. Then there are obviously, I suppose, areas where I'm non-negotiable would be a skill set issue, which would be your skills letting you down under pressure. That happens. It happens to the best of players. That's why you kind of repeat core skills and training under pressure. So even done at walking speed up to 100%, the capacity to, suppose, repeat the simple things and give your players confidence that when they're able to pull it out under pressure in the game, they have that in their cupboard. And then I suppose the third of the triangle of the three elements would be skill set. So that's in reviewing and previewing a game, is that what we practiced or rep during the week from a structure point of view. Have I my players well positioned to be able to make an impact on the gain line or on kickoff reception or on kickoff attack, that we have them fed mentally and instructed throughout the week to be able to perform and play with flow and tempo on Saturday? So that's how you kind of review your game. It's skill set error. Is it a structure error? Or more worryingly, is it a mindset error? If you're having issues with mindset, that's problems for the head coach. If it's structure and skill set, it's very fixable.
Okay. And have you been in an environment where it hasn't, or the coaching methodology has disappointed or challenged you?
Most definitely I have, yeah. But I suppose I'd flip that in his head, and where I'm absolutely not open to, I suppose, negotiation or debate on this would be having spent the two seasons with the Crusaders. It turned me upside down and inside out as a coach. I will always be a growth mindset person after seeing what I saw there. It transformed me, and it gave me, I suppose, nearly the will to live in terms of what 70 people aligned, positive, genuinely wanting their teammate to succeed looks like. It was so powerful, yet I suppose the negative monster inside me was eating away at me for 4 or 5 months gone, that's not sustainable, that's bullshit, that won't work. But thankfully I've left that behind, and I can see what actually caring looks like, what looking to bring out the best in your teammate. He could be your opponent, because even in a club structure, you've three number 10s looking to get the jersey. Only one of them can wear it, yet this number 2 can be an impact replacement. If you've got a great culture environment, the number 3 can also feel very appreciated. So that's up to, I suppose, the coaching staff to give the boys a carrot that, yeah, okay, I don't have a place for you this week, I don't have a place for you next week, but I'm thinking maybe that game there, you're going to get a chance. So hopefully you'll be able to take it. I think that's important. That what you don't want your players doing is, you don't want your players liking you, but you want your players respecting you. That's very important to me.
Hmm. No, it makes sense. If you think back, maybe just a little bit in terms of influences, who would you say your greatest influences were during your career as a player and even as your coach since then?
Yeah, it's a big question, I suppose. I would most definitely say the biggest influences for me were the Munster dressing room. I think from fellow players, I was lucky to go in as a young, well, not so young, but in my time a young, whatever, 20-year-old, 21, 22, with a lot of famous rugby players from Munster Rugby. And I learned a lot of, I think, important points about how you conduct yourself as a younger player, and then how you earn the right, to get your voice appreciated, and how you speak to people and how you get the best out of people. Yeah, I was with, you know, a lot of old school leaders, which for me are, nothing has changed, whether they're old school or new school. They still have such important messages to portray to their teammates. And then going into the Irish dressing room, it was the same. I think having spent time with a lot of coaches, I learned what I wouldn't use as a coach. And that's not a slight on them. But then there was great nuggets from all coaches, to be honest. I think when you spend a lot of time with people, you see what really is worthwhile. And I think, you know, I mean, at this stage of 45, I have an kind of an appreciation for what, how they got the best out of me. And we'd be here a long time, Connor, discussing that, I think, you know. But you pick up the nuggets,
right? And you can see the bits. Yeah.
You pick up the nuggets to a certain stage. And then, I suppose, having not travelled that much, going to France for the first time as what, a 36, 37-year-old, then going to New Zealand as a 41-year-old, I think. It's a good age, probably just at that barrier where, thankfully, I was in fixed mindset. And I think that just gave me a massive new launching pad to see the game differently, to see people differently.
Maybe just one last piece around the coaching style, Ronan. Theming is a large aspect of what you do. And talk to us a little bit about the role that theming plays in building mindset and culture.
Yeah, we need a few points to discuss this. You know, there's a lot in that question, to fully encapsulate what you're hoping to achieve or what you would like to do. But essentially, how it works, I suppose, is that players become inspired by, I suppose, resonating with a theme, T-H-E-M-E, obviously. And that works on a number of levels in terms, I suppose. The buy-in for me is crucial from the players. You know, I think that's why when you're doing it in one language, it's very, very, I suppose, convincing and powerful. But when you're putting all different cultures together and different, I suppose, learning manners in the French game, in the club game, for example, you have Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Georgians, French, Spanish, Argentinians, Irish, Scottish, Welsh, English, potentially in your squad, you know. So we all see life and the game very differently. So what may be very appealing to me may not resonate one bit with a Georgian player or a New Zealand player or a South African player. So I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to understand, I suppose, how you get the best out of them first, and that can be done through questionnaires, but also nothing beats time, I suppose, with them. And then if you feel, I suppose, or if you get an instinct that maybe theming may work with this group, then it can become very powerful. So it's essentially with your coaching group, you, I suppose, shoot the breeze about and brainstorm about what will resonate with this group or what will inspire this group. And then, I suppose, you tease it out, you draw it out, you map it out, you create a vision, and you say, okay, well, these are the stages involved and these are the pitfalls involved. But it becomes very, very, I suppose, appealing and interesting to people if they have something, I suppose, concrete that they can chase or they can go after in a short-term period, but also in a season-long period.
And, you know, you talk about buy-in being important. Is it 100% buy-in, or is there room for outliers in that system?
Yeah, you'll never get 100% buy-in. I think that's very important for me to state. You know, I think for people in sports, you probably have your core group, you've an outer group, and you've a group that you've lost. You'll always that, no matter how good you think you are, there'll always be, I suppose, people looking to put holes in your boat, and that's normal. You just got to make sure that, you don't get the double figures with those people, because that's when you get into trouble, and that's when you'll be sunk. So you'll always have, people like that, they see the negative, and that's fine, but I think that's something that's very important too as a coach. I think you've got to accept that on your coaching journey that, you know, it hit me at a period this season that I had probably three guys consuming most of my energy for 3 weeks. Then I had to have a look at myself, talk to people and say, how do I overcome this? And essentially, I had to go into a room and write down names of the people, and after their name, just do a simple tick, good guy. And when you see that for over 30 players or 35 players, you know that, I suppose, you're doing the job as best you can.
Yeah, and when you think about bringing new players into the squad, I guess, are you applying a filter around their mindset and their growth mindset and capability to take on these kind of things? How do you evaluate that?
yeah, you have to do your homework. Recruitment is so important. That's why I suppose the club game is so different from the test game, because at the test game there isn't really recruitment involved. It's coaching involved. See, the game
and you can drop people, right?
Yeah, but I think then, especially in the French model, there's so many opportunities that if you manage your squad well, there is always a role for them. I think, you know, that's important to say too. You know, you can't just keep playing the same players, and I suppose you have to constantly reviewing, I suppose, what you're trying to achieve and trying to do. But also, you know, I think if you do it well, you can give opportunities to younger players, to squad players, and because a team isn't going to win you anything. You need a group or a squad to get you over the line.
No, exactly. And what as you think about that, and you think about the advisors and the people that you need around you, how important are they in terms of the development of the club and the structures and everything else? And what do you look for in those people when you're bringing in people around you?
Yeah, well, that's why it's hard too, because that's, I think, where the lonely element comes into it in the French thing, because unless you probably live here and get it, it's very hard to offer advice. And that's important, I suppose, for younger players as well to understand, like, who are they getting their advice from? Is it, I mean, because sometimes the parents are too emotionally involved and they don't see it accurately. And as a result, maybe the information they're giving to their children because they love them may not be accurate. You need sometimes someone detached who's able to call it and be able to give the feedback. But like that, for people or players to have that network or mentor, he plays such an important role in that young girls or young boys' sporting career that's a decision you really have to get right. For me over here, you know, I think, I suppose it would be more talking to coaches that you've coached with around the world, and you just kind of, I suppose, get their opinion on one or two things. But a lot of it here, I suppose you've got to trust your instinct on it, and at the end of season, do a good, honest, self-appraisal of what left you down or what you did well.
No, okay, makes sense. Switching gears slightly, the business model around this, right? Because it certainly feels like in France, the clubs are, you know, they're backed by these wealthy individuals. There's more of a business side to it. Maybe you see that a little bit in England, I guess, as well, would be the other parallel. But how does the business model of the company or the club as a company take precedence over the actual performance of the rugby, and does it take over from the game itself sometimes?
No, I would say, in my experiences, so I've only been in two French clubs, you know, with Racing and now with La Rochelle, and the two models are extremely, extremely different. So in Racing Metro, it's Jackie Lorenzetti who finances absolutely everything. And when you think about that, the amount of money he's pumping into that club, and I suppose the opportunity he's given to coaches and players, you'd have to be extremely grateful for. The model in La Rochelle is very different in the fact that it's driven by 650 different sponsors. So I suppose during the COVID times, we were lucky in the fact that everyone was suffering, but at least it wasn't one person where there was no risk for the club going under. Sorry, no risk is the wrong words, but there was a far greater chance of staying afloat. So the models are very different in that regard. And then in La Rochelle, two key men are obviously Vincent Merling, who's the president, and then there's Pierre Vinaire, who's the CEO. And they run the club, but they don't interfere in the first team. So they have no say in the team, which happens in some French clubs, would you believe? And they don't, have any input onto the on-field environment, which is very, very important. So I'm let it run the way I want it to run with my staff. Otherwise, I think it wouldn't work. Is the brutal, honest answer in that regard.
With the way you approach it, because you have that framework that you want, a template, if you like, that as you see it and your mindset towards coaching, and you need to have the control around that to implement it effectively.
Yeah, exactly. But then obviously, you know, they're sharp operators, the guys who are running the club as well, so they'd have a fair idea of what's going on, so they'd be able to mark your car, we're happy with that and that. And thankfully, my situation so far, it's been progressive, and that's what you're looking to do. Yeah. It's extremely difficult, obviously, to win, but we're not far away from it. We're knocking on the door. There's a good vibe around our club and it's seen in a good light. And that's very important as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Back to Irish rugby, maybe to finish up. You've been out of Ireland for almost 10 years now, I think. And as you look back to provincially and the national team today, what are the main changes that you've seen, I guess, in Irish rugby from a high performance perspective since you've moved on from Ireland?
I think what's very obvious is the consistency of performance. I think the Irish national team is performing consistently well. Obviously, the proof for that would be Rugby World Cup in 18 months' time. But everything points to a very positive performance in that competition. I think you look at the strength of the provinces, and it's something that a lot of nations would be jealous of, I suppose, the stability and the strength of the provinces competing year in, year out at Champions Cup level, and also the IRFU keeping control of their players. You can see how important that is, I suppose, to longevity of careers, to player management, to player welfare. And the Irish model will be the envy of a lot of nations around the world. That's for certain. So, yeah, I think, as you said, I'm out 10 years, so I don't have any idea how it's run internally there. And I may be way off the pace. I suppose I see consistency from the years 2000. I think Ireland were batting above its average. No, they're not, obviously, because they're established at the top table of world rugby, and that's a great place for them to be.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, maybe just to finish up, is that the perception that the French clubs would have? I mean, we see from Ireland, we're looking out and we see the provincial sides doing so well and consistently. And is there a fear factor from the other side of the water there in terms of France looking across, or are we putting ourselves higher than we're perceived elsewhere, if that makes sense?
No, I suppose what's evident now is the fact, I suppose, what the lessons, you mean, certainly the French Federation took on board, I suppose, from looking at the Irish model, even though that never became public. But like, the guys who play test matches for France have never been better looked after. So there's actually rest periods and they're ring fenced in terms of when they can play games, which was never the case, would you believe, up to 3 years ago. So guys could play on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock at Toulouse, for example, La Rochelle game, and the following Saturday they'd be playing against Ireland, you know, which gives Ireland an advantage. It doesn't give France an advantage, because yes, you do need to be game hardened and you do get game hardened, but there is also a point where all the best players, they just need their program managed to the best of their ability. You know, if you're playing week in, week out for 40 weeks, it's going to take a toll. Maybe not in the short term, but definitely in the long run.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, Ronan, I think that wraps up everything we wanted to cover. And, you know, thank you for making yourself available and for sharing your thoughts with us. And the very best of luck with everything in La Rochelle. Thank you to Ronan O'Gara for a fantastic chat and giving myself and the listeners some fascinating insights. That's it for this episode of Triton Lake Perform. We hope you enjoyed the chat and tune in again soon. Thanks again for listening.